Well, our theme for 2023 is life in the Spirit. And what I mean by life in the Spirit is that we are living at the intersection of earthly reality and spiritual reality. That's what the church is. We are the intersection of heavenly reality and spiritual reality. In this series, which is an expository study of the book of 1 Corinthians, I'm calling it the Spirit-Filled Church. But we are also seeking to answer the question, so what is the Spirit-Filled Church filled with? What does the Spirit do with, for, in the church? Well, the first week we talked about the Spirit fills the church with power. And that power is not the power to control, but it's the power to not have to control. It's a different kind of power. The Spirit also fills the church with wisdom, but it's not a worldly wisdom. Rather, it's a wisdom that asks why and to what end. The Spirit calls the church to holiness. We talked about how only the Spirit can make us holy because God is holy. And last week we said that the Spirit gives the church a unique purpose. And the way that we live our lives and our choices, they're part of a bigger plan to bring everything in heaven and on earth under the lordship of Jesus Christ. So what else does the Spirit bring to the church? How about the glory of God? The glory of God is the splendor and brilliant beauty that shines through all of the divine attributes, but is especially evident in the crucified and risen Christ. Wonderful definition for the glory of God. Now, the glory of God is only mentioned twice in these two chapters, and we're going to be talking about 1 Corinthians chapters 9 and 10 today. It's at the end of chapter 10, but it will be mentioned again in chapters 11 and in chapter 15. It's a theme in the letter, just kind of right below the surface. And while the exact word glory of God may not be used very often, the concept is being continually developed in Paul's letter to the Corinthians. Now, in 2 Corinthians, Paul talks a lot about the glory of God. This passage from 2 Corinthians 3, 17 and 18 says, "Now the Lord is the Spirit, and where the Spirit of the Lord is, there is freedom. And we all, with unveiled face, beholding the glory of the Lord, are being transformed into the same image from one degree of glory to another. For this comes from the Lord, who is the Spirit." So the Spirit brings the glory of God to the church. And the glory of God is the sheer brilliance of his attributes. It's his awesomeness, to use the modern vernacular. Do you know what is really awesome about God's glory? That when we see his awesomeness, we are transformed into the same image. We become what we see. And we go from one degree of awesomeness to another. Everyone wants to be awesome. In 2014, I took my kids to see the Lego movie. Remember this one? Everything is awesome, right? That was the song. And it's like, it would, once you hear that song, I'm sorry, Jason, it'll be stuck in your head now for the rest of the day. Everything is awesome. Everything is cool when you're part of a team. Everything is awesome when you're living out a dream. Everything is better when we stick together, side by side. You and I are going to win forever. Let's party forever. We're the same. I'm like you. You're like me. We're working in harmony. Everything is awesome. Now, you got it in your head too, Julie, right? You know, I think they were trying to capture something, right? That desire that everyone has to be part of something really huge and wonderful and important for the Christian, that's the glory of God. He's awesome. And this is what it says in 1 Corinthians 10:31. Whether you eat or drink, live your life in a way that glorifies and honors God. Going back to an older time, the Westminster Shorter Catechism from 1647 is famous for its first question and answer. Maybe you've heard of this. Question one, what is the chief end of man? And the answer is this: man's chief end is to glorify God and to enjoy Him forever. What's it all about? What's the meaning of life? What is everything coming to? What is the purpose of all of this? And the answer is, our purpose is to glorify God and to enjoy Him forever. You can live for your own glory. You can try to be awesome on your own, and there's a lot of people doing that. Or you can live for the glory of God, reflecting and being part of His awesomeness. Which do you think is more likely to work for you? What were you created for? Living for the glory of God, well, it's going to mean surrendering your life to God, letting go of your rights, letting go of your desires, your ambitions, in order to receive His. It's going to mean committing to a process of transformation, that beholding His glory, that is also transforming us into His likeness. That's a process. And it results in our full participation, together with others, in something that is so much greater, so much better than what any of us could be or do on our own. It's all about the glory of God and living for His glory. So if you're following along in your outline, which is in your bulletin, or those of you online, the digital bulletin, the first point is this: the glory of surrender. You've heard me say that the Christian life is a divine exchange. I've said this before. It's an exchange. It's all of you for all of Him. You get that? You want all of Him, then He gets all of you. That's the way this works. Paul describes it as putting off and putting on. And he uses that language in more than one place, but just for example, Colossians 3, 9 and 10, do not lie to one another, seeing that you have put off the old self with its practices, and you have put on the new self, which is being renewed in the knowledge after the image of its creator. So glorifying God begins with the surrender of yourself to God. It's laying something down to take something else up. It's taking something off to put something else on. It's surrendering so that you can begin anew. So what are we surrendering? Let's begin reading in chapter 9. And the first point is this: surrender yourself, your sense of entitlement. Let's begin there. Surrender yourself, your sense of entitlement. 1 Corinthians 9, verses 1 through 11. Now, this is Paul speaking. Am I not free? Am I not an apostle? Have I not seen Jesus our Lord? Are you not my workmanship in the Lord? If to others I am not an apostle, at least I am to you, for you are the seal of my apostleship in the Lord. And this is my defense to those who would examine me. Do we not have the right to eat and drink? Do we not have the right to take along a believing wife, as do the other apostles and the brothers of the Lord and Cephas, who's Peter, by the way? Or is it only Barnabas and I who have no right to refrain from working for a living? Who serves as a soldier at his own expense? Who plants a vineyard without eating of its fruit? Or who tends a flock without getting some of the milk? Do I say these things on human authority? Does not the law say the same? For it's written in the law of Moses, you shall not muzzle the ox when it treads out the grain. Is it for oxen that God is concerned? Does he not certainly speak for our sake? As it is written, for our sake, because the plowman should plow in hope and the thresher should thresh in hope of sharing in the crop. So if we've sown spiritual things among you, is it too much if we reap material things from you? What do you think are your rights? What are your rights? Charlie, you're getting ahead of me. Do we come to God with a list of demands? Right? Did you come to God thinking God was going to make your life better? And then when things go wrong, you're like, hey, God, this isn't what I signed up for. If you were to list all the things that you believe you're entitled to, what would be on that list? Does God owe you anything? So in Corinth, Paul is writing to the Corinthians. They're Roman citizens, and Roman citizens are privileged with certain rights. That was part of what it meant to be a Roman citizen. You have some rights. You have the right to marry. You have the right to own property. You have the right to vote, the right to run for public office. You have the right to conduct business, and you have the right to move freely about the Roman territories with a certain measure of protection. Now, Paul was able to take advantage of that at certain times in his ministry. But not everyone had these rights. Slaves, for example, did not have the rights of citizens, and neither did the conquered peoples, which the Jews were, by the way. But Paul was a Roman citizen, even though he was a Jew, probably received that in exchange for some service that was rendered by his family. We know that Paul was a tent maker. Some have suggested that perhaps his family made tents for the Roman army. Paul never mentions his citizenship in his own writing. He never talks about that. That's mentioned about him in Acts, but he never mentions it himself. How does Paul describe himself? He describes himself as a slave, as a bondservant of Jesus Christ. For example, Romans 1, chapter 1, this is how Paul starts out his letter. Paul, a bondservant of Jesus Christ, called to be an apostle, separated to the gospel of God. As far as Paul was concerned, he's a Roman citizen, but he has given up his rights to follow Jesus. He only mentions his rights in this passage to say later that he has chosen not to claim those rights. He's not in it for the money. He's not in it for power. He's not in it for fame. There is only one thing that matters, and that's what it means to surrender to Jesus Christ. So here's the next fill in the blank. Surrender your rights. Surrender your ambition. Let's pick up in verse 12. If others share this rightful claim on you, do not we even more? Nevertheless, we have not made use of this right, but we endure anything rather than put an obstacle in the way of the gospel of Christ. Do you not know that those who are employed in the temple service get their food from the temple? And those who serve at the altar share in the sacrificial offerings? In the same way, the Lord commanded that those who proclaim the gospel should get their living by the gospel. But I've made no use of these rights. Nor am I writing these things to secure any such provision. For I would rather die than have anyone deprive me of my ground for boasting. For if I preach the gospel, that gives me no ground for boasting, but necessity is laid upon me. "Woe to me if I do not preach the gospel. If I do this of my own will, I have a reward. But if not of my own will, then I am entrusted with a stewardship. What then is my reward? That in preaching I may present the gospel free of charge, so as not to make use of my full right in the gospel." So Paul is making the argument that there's a place for full-time ministry. After all, the Levites in the Old Testament, they made their living primarily from the offerings that were brought to the temple. So here's what I want you to understand from this. So in the world, we understand business, right? Business exists primarily to make money. You aren't in business if you don't make money. At least you don't stay in business if you don't make money. But ministry is different. Ministry is not about money. Ministry exists to serve people by moving them from where they are and toward where God wants them to be. That's what ministry is. Whether or not you get paid for doing it is secondary. Certainly, Paul makes the argument he is entitled to be paid, but guess what? He's given up his entitlement, as do a lot of people who serve in ministry. At Spring City Fellowship, why do we exist? This is our mission statement. Can you remember it? We exist to help people what? Encounter God's transforming love. That's why we exist. That's our mission. Now, I'm fortunate to be able to devote my full time to this vision. Plus, I have time to do some counseling. I have time to do some studying, and Carrie and I are able to travel and support the work of missions. We're blessed to be able to do that. But you know what? If I did not receive a salary, I would still be doing ministry because I'm called to ministry. If I was still working in carpentry, that would be my ministry. And I would do it as a ministry. Perhaps I wouldn't be able to do all that I'm doing now, but I'm blessed to be able to do that because ministry is not just a job, ministry is a calling. Carrie and I just met with a young couple yesterday who was serving in ministry and things got rough and God called them to something else. And I said to him when we left, I said, "Now remember, it's all ministry. It's all ministry. Whatever you do, whatever God has called you to, it's not just a job. It's a calling. So God called me to serve him. And guess what? Because I am called by God, I'm going to find a way to serve him, even if it means doing it in carpentry or a laundromat. For a number of years, I was bivocational. That is to say, I supported myself in ministry. I worked as a pastor, and I also did carpentry. In fact, when I started out on staff at the Telford Church, I was completely a volunteer. Didn't have any salary at all. I just started out one day a week as a pastor and doing carpentry 4 days a week. And then a little bit later, the church was able to pay me for one day a week. But I shared this with the brothers in India, and they were like blown away by this. I worked one day a week for the church and received a salary for one day a week, but I worked in carpentry 4 days a week, and I tithed on my carpentry money back to the church. What I was tithing on 4 days a week was more than my one day a week salary. Okay, do the math, and you can figure out that a pastor's salary is not equivalent to what a carpenter makes. Okay? Now, I'm not complaining, and neither is Paul. If anything, we are boasting in a good way, because we are proud to serve in a cause that is greater than any job we could have. That's the kingdom of God. It's all about his glory. It's not about money. It's not about power. It's not about fame. It's for his glory. Here's something else to surrender. Surrender your preferences. Surrender your preferences. Picking up in verse 19. For though I am free from all, I have made myself a servant to all, that I might win more of them. To the Jews I became as a Jew, in order to win the Jews. To those under the law I became as one under the law, though I myself am not under the law, that I might win those under the law. To those outside the law, I became as one outside the law, not being outside the law of God, but under the law of Christ, that I might win those outside the law. To the weak, I became weak, that I might win the weak. I have become all things to all people, that by all means I might save some. And I do it all for the sake of the gospel, that I may share with them in its blessings. So why am I telling you this? And why is Paul saying all of this? It's because we want you to think in terms of becoming more like Jesus. What did Jesus do? He came down from heaven. He gave up his rights, his divine glory, and some of those abilities to become one of us. That's called the incarnation. Talk about taking a demotion. Jesus took a big demotion, a huge demotion. He gave up his rights to serve humanity. And Jesus allowed himself to be humiliated, beaten, and hung on a cross to save us. And after all that, we still have people who will only serve God if they get the right salary, or if they get the right title, or if they at least have a nice office. What's wrong with that picture? It's not about us. It's not about our rights. It's not about what we're entitled to. It has nothing to do with what we want or what we may get out of it. It's all about him. And it's for his glory. And sometimes we need to remind ourselves of that. Revelation 1:6 says this: he lets us rule as kings and serve God his Father as priests. But to him be glory and power forever and ever. Amen. It's all about him. We have the privilege of serving for his glory. Now, that's not a natural human way of thinking about things, but that is the work of the Spirit transforming the church. Let's talk more about transformation. This is the second point, the glory of transformation. So remember, I'm saying that the church is the intersection of earthly reality and spiritual reality. So the Spirit is transforming the church to represent and to transact spiritual reality on earth. That's what the church is for. And that means that we are all people in a very special process. It's not necessarily an easy process, but it is a glorious process. Here's your next fill in the blank. Transformation involves discipline. Ooh, that word hurt a little bit, didn't it? Let's pick up in verse 24. Do you not know that in a race, all the runners run, but only one receives the prize? So run that you may obtain it. Every athlete exercises self-control in all things, and they do it to receive a perishable wreath, but we an imperishable. So I do not run aimlessly. I do not box as one beating the air, but I discipline my body and I keep it under control, lest after preaching to others, I myself should be disqualified. Everything that's worth doing usually requires some effort. If it didn't require effort, I think everybody would be doing it, right? Living in spiritual reality is going to take some effort. It's going to take some retraining of our minds. Every child learns that just doing what comes naturally does not lead to maturity. Hebrews 12:9 in the Passion Translation says this, "And isn't it true that we respect our earthly fathers, even though they corrected and disciplined us?" My dad's sitting in the audience. Thank you, Dad. "And we should demonstrate even greater respect for God, our spiritual father, as we submit to his life-giving discipline." The same is true for learning to live in spiritual reality, with spiritual maturity. What do we say in physical exercise? We have a saying, right? No pain, no gain. You heard that one? Do you expect your spiritual development to be painless? We need to focus. Key is, don't focus on the pain, focus on the result. That's the glory of God. That's why we're doing this. It's not my glory, it's for his glory. And I'm just becoming the one that he originally created me to be, being transformed into his image from one degree of glory to another. Here's the next thing that transformation requires. Transformation requires faith. Now we're into chapter 10. "For I do not want you to be unaware, brothers, that our fathers were all under the cloud, and all passed through the sea, and all were baptized into Moses in the cloud and in the sea, and all ate the same spiritual food," manna, by the way, "and all drank the same spiritual drink, water from a rock. For they drank from the spiritual rock that followed them, and that rock was Christ." Love how they mix metaphors. The rock and the cloud are the same thing. "Nevertheless, with most of them, God was not pleased, for they were overthrown in the wilderness." Now, this is supposed to be a pep talk, right? It's like the coach bringing the team into the locker room at halftime and saying, "Okay, guys, you can go out there and you can make plays, but we can still lose this game." Right? "You can do your best, but your best might not be enough. Going through the motions is not enough. Being religious is not enough. Just doing church as usual, it's not enough. We have to dig deep. You got to dig deep. You got to find something extraordinary inside yourself. And let's go out there and let's do something that we've never done before." Right? That's what Paul's saying here. Psalm 106 verses 24 and 25, "The people refused to enter the pleasant land, for they wouldn't believe his promise to care for them. Instead, they grumbled in their tents, and they refused to obey the Lord." Some never received the promise. They did everything. They were there. They experienced it all. They were in church every Sunday, but they missed it. Why? Because it wasn't faith. Glory only comes by faith. I'm sorry for being such a downer, because I know some of you are you're starting to go there. You're thinking, "I don't think I have what it takes." Congratulations! You don't have what it takes. And it's about time you realize that. You don't have what it takes, but God does. That's what faith is. He put His Spirit in you to empower you to do what only He can do. You just have to trust Him enough to obey Him. 2 Corinthians 5:7 in the Amplified Bible says this, "For we walk by faith. We regulate our lives and conduct ourselves by our conviction or our belief respecting man's relationship to God and divine things with trust and holy fervor. Thus we walk not by sight or appearance." Glory is not the pinnacle of self-improvement. It's the result of self-surrender. We are not climbing the ladder of success. We are incarnating Christ to the lowest and darkest places of the earth. Faith is not a state of enlightenment. It's a daily walk in obedience, doing everything to the glory of God. Here's the next thing transformation does. Transformation engages our will. It engages our will. Picking up in verse 6. "Now these things took place as an example for us, that we might not desire evil as they did. Do not be idolaters as some of them were, as it is written, the people sat down to eat and drink and rose up to play. We must not indulge in sexual immorality as some of them did, and 23,000 fell in a single day. We must not put Christ to the test as some of them did and were destroyed by serpents, nor grumble as some of them did and were destroyed by the destroyer. Now these things happened to them as an example, but they were written down for our instruction, to whom the end of the ages has come. Therefore, let anyone who thinks that he stands take heed lest he fall. No temptation has overtaken you that is not common to man. God is faithful, and he will not let you be tempted beyond your ability, but with the temptation, he will also provide a way of escape that you may be able to endure it." So how many people have tried and how many people have failed? And how do you and I think that we are going to be any different from them? Well, we have this advantage. We can learn from their mistakes. It's important that we don't get cocky here, because the sinful nature is inherently selfish. Now, for most of us sitting here in the church, the devil knows he's not going to get you by tempting you with evil, right? What's he going to tempt you with? He's going to tempt you to focus on yourself. You deserve a little pity. You deserve some self-indulgence. You deserve more recognition than what you're getting. Be careful. It's a trap. But with that trap, there is also an escape. Get your eyes back on Jesus. It's for His glory. There's the escape hatch. Let's talk about the glory of participation. The glory of participation. Participation, what does that even mean? You know, we give out trophies to kids just for playing sports, you know. Some people think this is a joke. You know, only winners deserve trophies, right? Don't think of participation as a trophy. Think of it as a team jacket, right? Can we get that next slide there? Not a trophy, it's a team jacket. You are part of an amazing team that is accomplishing something together that none of us could do on our own. You're part of something much bigger than yourself. So here's what participation means. Participation means that you belong. You got that? Participation means that you belong. It's like when people see that jacket. Oh, you're on the team. You can see that, you know? You belong to something bigger than yourself. Let me pick up in verse 14 with Paul's writing. Therefore, my beloved, flee from idolatry. I speak as to sensible people. Judge for yourselves what I say. The cup of blessing that we bless, he's talking about communion, is it not participation in the blood of Christ? The bread that we break, and we do this all together, is it not participation in the body of Christ? Because there's one bread, we who are many are one body. That's why we all partake of one bread. Consider the people of Israel. Are not those who eat the sacrifices participants in the altar? Now let me give you a little context here, because he's first of all talking to people who are in the context of idol worship. Now, idol worship is not about participation. It's about appeasement. You get this picture? We inferior humans are bringing our measly little sacrifices to a deity in fear and trembling, just hoping that that deity will not be angry with us. That's the way idol worship happens. Some people worship God that way. Don't you see it? Thinking God is always angry with them and they're just trying to keep God happy. That's not the God that we serve. You realize when we celebrate communion, when we celebrate the body and the blood of Christ, we are celebrating something that Jesus has already done. He's already done it. There's no suspense here. Romans 5:8 says this, but God proves his own love for us in that while we were still sinners, Christ died for us. You see how that's the opposite of appeasement? There's no bargaining here. He's done it. There's no groveling. He's already done it. This should not be tantalizing to us as to whether or not we are good enough or whether or not our offering is acceptable. God has already atoned for our sin. It's up to you whether you're in or out. God has already made clear his intention. He's already made clear his plan for the world. And it's not a question of whether or not he is for you or whether he is with you. The question is, are you with him? Let's move on. Belonging is necessarily exclusive of evil. Belonging is necessarily exclusive of evil. Picking up in verse 19. What do I imply then? That food offered to idols is anything, or that an idol is anything? No, I imply that what pagans sacrifice to offer, I imply that what pagans sacrifice, they offer to demons and not to God. And I do not want you to be a participant with demons. You cannot drink the cup of the Lord and the cup of demons. You cannot partake of the table of the Lord and the table of demons. Shall we provoke the Lord to jealousy? Are we stronger than he? All things are lawful, but not all things are helpful. All things are lawful, but not all things build up. So Paul is repeating something that he said earlier. This sounds a lot like what we were talking about last week. The question is not, is it legal? The question is it helpful? God has a plan. And there may be some things in our lives that, well, they may not exactly be wrong, but they're not right either. They're not right in the sense that they are not moving us where we need to be going. Just as far as food offered to idols, you know, some people were saying, well, an idol's nothing, you know, you can eat that food and you can get away with it. But here's the thing Paul's saying, yes, you can eat it and you can get away with it, but what message are you sending? You might be sending entirely the wrong message, especially considering who might be around at that moment. You are partnering with the enemy, at least in appearance, and perhaps even more than you know. You know, there's a lot of things, a lot of cultural things in our society that good Christians may disagree on. When I was growing up, it was things like music and movies, right? Christians disagreed on that. Now it's Netflix, podcasts, and video games, right? Or it could be some brand identity. What? Oh, you mean you do that? You wear that? You drive that? Could be some affiliation. It could be various ideologies being pro this or anti that. What's a Christian supposed to do or not do? Some things are difficult to discern. Is it really bad or is it just a fad? Do we watch Harry Potter or don't we? No? What is it? Some things, some causes have legitimate goals, but they can also have a hidden agenda. Can we just establish one thing? We are not going to knowingly partner with the enemy, right? There may be some things that we feel differently about, we don't have conviction about, we're not aware. But can we just say that we are not going to knowingly partner with the enemy? Evil does exist. Evil does exist, and to the extent that we are aware of it, please, please hear me, have nothing to do with it. Here's the other side of things, though. Belonging is, however, inclusive of people, inclusive of other people. Paul continues, let no one seek his own good, but the good of his neighbor. Eat whatever is sold in the meat market without raising any question on the ground of conscience. For the earth is the Lord's and the fullness thereof. That's Psalms 24. If any one of the unbelievers invites you to dinner and you're disposed to go, eat whatever's set before you without raising a question on the ground of conscience. But if someone says to you, this has been offered in sacrifice, then do not eat for the sake of the one who informed you and for the sake of conscience. I did not mean your conscience, but his. For why should my liberty be determined by someone else's conscience? If I partake with thankfulness, why am I denounced because of that for which I give thanks? So here's the summary statement. So whether you eat or drink, or whatever you do, do all to the glory of God. Give no offense to Jews or to Greeks or to the church of God. Just as I try to please everyone in everything I do, I'm not seeking my own advantage, but that of the many. That many may be saved. So here's a clarifying point. When I say I will not partner with the enemy, I want to clarify, people are not the enemy. You get it? People are not the enemy. Satan will use some people to accomplish his agenda, but I find that for the most part, the people that he's using are not aware of it. And they may not even see themselves as partnering with evil. There are many people with whom I strongly disagree about certain current events. But I want you to know, I do not consider them evil. I may think that they're deceived, but I don't question their motives. And that provides a basic foundation of respect that enables us to have intelligent conversations. And you know what I've found out in some of those conversations? I've found out that there are certain things in which I may be deceived also. Sometimes I can be wrong. Sometimes I can be used of the enemy. Even non-believers need to be approached with a basic respect as a person created in God's image. Now, remember when we had Drew from the Jesus generation here and his brother Adam, they were teaching on evangelism. And I tell you, one of the things I love about their approach is these guys see everyone they meet as a son or a daughter of God made in his image. They just don't know it yet, right? See a guy on the street, that's a son of God. I wonder if he knows it. That's a daughter of God. I wonder if she knows it. I better tell him. You know, especially when we are relating to people, it's helpful not to focus on what's bad about people or what they're doing wrong. You know, you approach somebody, it's like, hey, did you know you're a sinner and you're going to hell? You think they're going to listen to the next line? Learn to see the glory of God reflected in each and every person you meet. Because each person, whether they know it or not, they are created in his image. They may not be reflecting it much yet, but they can be. And perhaps they will be. In fact, make the glory of God the focus for your entire life. Make it the basis for which you make every decision. Make it the reason you do what you do. Make it the reason you get up in the morning. And also make it the reason why you choose not to do certain things. God is transforming you to look more and more like Jesus. Here's what I want you to remember. It's not about me. It's all about him. Can you say it with me? It's not about me. It's all about him. That is living for the glory of God. So here's some questions for reflection. As you think about this and pray about this week. Number one, what are your rights? What are your rights? Think about that. What do I consider my rights to be? And then I wanted you to ask another question. What could possibly be so important or enticing that it would be worth giving up those rights? How about the glory of God? Does the glory of God fit that description? And then I want you to ask one more question. Are you pursuing his glory or yours? Number two, what are you focused on? When life is hard and when you need to persevere, what gets you through? You know, whatever you are focused on, that is what you are becoming. So, Are your faith and your focus, are they pointed at the same goal? Number three, do you feel that you belong to the body of Christ? Do you have the team jacket? How does belonging change the way you make decisions? Is it truly awesome to be part of a team? Then ask yourself another question. Is glory something that anyone can ever achieve on their own? Let's stand and worship as we close with this song.